At the end. We'll do them at the end.
Flip a coin.
Flip a coin to do it or not?
To decide, yeah.
Who's got a coin?
No, just go with you, go with what you want to do.
A trillion dollar coin.
Right, that one that we needed, yeah, yeah. So thank you so much for joining us. Everyone knows you, Wendy, but I looked to get your website update, and you know, you haven't updated your website in 8 years.
That's actually not on my current website.
Oh, okay.
So that's right. I know.
Okay. That's when you were an assistant professor.
Unfortunately.
So that's 4 years better than the division?
Our website?
Yeah.
We're very proud of it. It's going to change. Yes, yes. So for those of you on the phone or who may not know, Dr. Slusser is an associate professor in pediatrics at UCLA, but also co-founds and is the medical director of the Fit for Healthy Weight Program, directs the Venice Family Clinic Pediatric Health and Wellness Program, graduated cum laude from Princeton, received her medical master's degrees from Columbia University, and then came west, joined UCLA in 96. 13 years? Wow.
17.
Wow, okay, it's my math. And has been tremendously engaged and truly leading us nationwide in family and clinic and school and community-based programs in health promotion and infant and child nutrition. And our theme the last couple of times has circled around stakeholder engagement, because we see, we being the rapid response team, people want to understand how do we really do it and how do we get PCORI funding for doing it. And PCORI set these very high standards for stakeholder, authentic stakeholder engagement that involved being at the table when the study is designed right through to dissemination and implementation. They backed off a little bit on this, and Brian Mittman's going to be joining us. He's on the methodology committee and has the new standards. Come back a little bit, but still the bar is high, and we're ever striving to understand how we can reach it, and you have reached it. So tell us about it.
Okay, well, thank you so much for the nice introduction and including me. I actually am not an expert in engagement. I think I part of the University of Life graduates of engagement. And so what I'm going to try to do in the next lunch hour is review some of the strategies to build stakeholder engagement that I actually utilized in my studies since I joined UCLA in the mid-90s. And also review some of the advantages to engage stakeholders. I think most of you have probably a laundry list of ideas also what you think would be an advantage, and I would love to hear from you as well. I guess the first question always is, who are stakeholders? I mean, you can pretty much define everybody in this room as a stakeholder in some respect, as well as, of course, if you look at the core stakeholders, from my perspective, I'm working with families and parents, pediatrician. And then certainly you can't forget their friends and families and communities and organizations. So all of these obviously are stakeholders. And so what I'm going to do today is illustrate how I worked with various levels of these stakeholders over the course of my time here in the past 17 years. Certainly the first thing in terms of just engaging people in general is motivation. And we know that motivation is complicated. And I want a fitness video, do you deliver? This is something I think we all contend with on our personal level, as well as working with others when we might have an idea of something that's important, but maybe it's not so important to that group, and what is important. So of course, the advantages to building stakeholder engagement, from my point of view, and I know there's lots of other levels of advantages, but from my point of view, it's a community-based capacity-building approach that aims to promote sustainable skill development, strengthen communities, and increase the ability of individuals to effectively address and improve health outcomes. And what this can do is influence the underlying social and economic determinants of health in a flexible, sustainable, equitable, and safe manner. So if you look at the individual level, the motivational interviewing approach is a strategy that you can utilize to engage people to make changes within their own personal life. And I've certainly used these skill set as well as in terms of working in group settings as well. But it's important for us all to understand that it's a method of communication rather than a set of techniques, and it's not a bag of tricks for getting people to do what they don't want to do. Rather, it's a fundamental way of being with and for people, and it's a facilitative approach to communication that evokes change. The other strategies that I've utilized for engaging stakeholders are utilizing what McKnight has well described in his institute at Northwestern, the asset mapping and mobilization approach. And then also, of course, we all know about the community-based participatory research approach, which really the key tenet of that is identifying assets to facilitate health, and the resulting interventions are more likely to leverage individual institutional community assets.
Can you say more about motivational interviewing? Because I think I know what it is, but I'm trying to be sure at the same time.
Sure, and you know, it's something that was developed initially in psychology for the change of alcoholism, basically. And since then, it's been applied in the medical world for tobacco counseling. Family physicians in particular have taken on utilizing it, and most recently in the last 5 years it's been recommended and starting to be studied to be utilized for changing nutritional and physical activity behaviors to promote health and well-being among children as well as adults. And we've been utilizing it in the pediatric residency program now, training our residents for the last 3 to 4 years, and it's transformed our practice. We've seen from potentially individual changes of just maintaining weight gain in terms of the kids to weight loss. And that was the tipping point, was introducing motivational interviewing.
Can I follow up real quick? Because I think I took an online course once, and the thing I remember most is, isn't it sort of like you're trying to just facilitate the other person to learn how to kind of get inside their head and then figure out what to do to change their life? I mean, I just
That's exactly right. It's completely patient-centered. And there's a system that you can remember by ORS. O is open-ended questions, A. O for ORS is open-ended questions, A is affirmation, R is reflection, and S is summarizing. And that's sort of the systemized way of how you approach it. You want to have at least 50% of your questions open-ended, not closed-ended. And within that context, you can actually identify areas that people want to work on to improve themselves. And they might not be ready for change, of course, so that would minimize your approach to MI, but for that particular visit. And that's on the individual basis, but you could actually utilize this. I use this with my husband all the time, actually. I guess that's individualized. I use it with my adolescents, too, but yes.
Well, the implication there is that it all emanates from within the individual and none of it is imposed.
Correct.
But you obviously go in with an agenda, like you think they ought to lose some weight or take some pills or change behaviors and so on. So, it's kind of a fine line saying what's coming from within and what's...
Absolutely. So there's two things that you know, as simple, like for in terms of primary care, in a primary care setting, to simplify that kind of challenge, is that you ask people, and you sort of obviously are focusing your conversation with them, but you ask them from 1 to 10, what's the most important thing for that? Why is this important to you? For instance, is it important to you to be physically fit, or 1 to 10? And, you know, often people will say 10, because it is important to them. Maybe not. Some will say 3. I mean, and then you sort of move on. Like, that's not the topic you're going to talk about at that point. You have to obviously be ready for change. There's a description, you know, you kind of have to evaluate that as well before you utilize motivational interviewing. But say they do say 10. Then you go 1 to 10. And then you say, so why don't you say a 5? Why is it so important to you? So you learn about why it's important to them. It might not be the same reasons that it's important to you as the physician or provider. But you learn why it's important to that individual. And then you go 1 to 10, how confident are you that you can become more physically fit? And usually it's less, people are not that confident. They say 5. And then you say, so why don't you say 3? And so you hear what they do, all this change talk. Well, I think I'm a five because I've done it before. I started working out. And so then you start having them tell you how they're good. They tell you how they're going to change.
But isn't it likely that people who communicate, who have better verbal communication skills, are more likely to be able to articulate that they want something? I mean, I would think of this sort of, the people around here, you know, pretty much would answer top of the scale for wanting to optimize all their health behaviors. Whereas other people might not be able to figure out that they do, even if on some level they do, or they're afraid to acknowledge that they do, and so on. So, I mean, is there evidence that this works better in some social classes and groupings than in others?
You know, that's a really good question. I can just speak from my own I haven't reviewed the literature comparing different classes and socioeconomic groups. I can just speak from my own personal experiences and the data that we've been collecting from Venice Family Clinic, that it's very effective among our patient population. We might not use the number scale, 1 to 10. We might use very important versus not so important, because there are some nuances, especially with some of our parents who are second grade educated mostly. But in terms of the interactions that we have with, for instance, the children that I interact with, who usually I start using this with 10-year-olds, and before that I'm using it with the parent, they really get it, and the parents get it too, but they might not articulate it in such a, you know, defined numeric way. But I have to tell you, all our families in our clinic care about. They want their kids to be healthy, and that's their number one priority. And that's
right.
The ones, at least, that come to the clinic. You know, yeah.
I assume you can also start with a sort of least common denominator. So if, you know, starting with, you know, I'd like to exercise is not appropriate. Starting with, you know, a question, you know, would you like to be around when your kids are older?
Correct.
Some way of finding, I guess, a hook that you know they're likely to at least say, you know, a five. And then working from there, is it customized in that manner?
Well, your point is really well taken, because everyone has different reasons for wanting to be healthy. So rather than saying you giving them that idea, you would say, they might tell you that. They might say, I'm at a five because I want to be there for my kids. Or if they get stumped, which is something that some of our families do, if they are not, you know, don't know, or they know but they don't know why they care, is that you ask for permission. You say, would it be okay for me to give you some ideas? And you'll never get, the change in body language is tremendous. People will sit back and go, sure. No one's ever said no to me. And then, but the fact that I've asked them permission to give them an idea, rather than just throwing out my ideas, which is really the reaction that most doctors, including myself, I'm always trying to hold myself back. You know, it's tremendous how relaxed people get when you ask permission to give them ideas, mm-hmm. if they've run out of ideas. So this is, the motivational interviewing is really engaging individual stakeholders, at least in my experience. And then these other strategies that I've utilized and others have, are more potentially related to, you know, they're more community-based. Although asset mapping, if you really think about it, and mobilization is also a form of motivational interviewing from an individual. If you're looking at individuals' assets and mobilizing those to make change.
Wait, can you elaborate on that, please, Wendy?
Whenever I think of asset mapping,
yeah.
I think, you know, everyone has strengths, and that's what you want the individual to look into, uh-huh. through the, you know, motivational interviewing, utilizing their strengths. Mm-hmm. And that's what whenever I train our residents, we train our residents to do asset mapping and mobilization of the community around Venice Family Clinic. I also say this is very similar to the motivational interviewing in the sense that you're looking for the positives, not the negatives. Mm-hmm. And so what are the positives? Maybe, you know, the father's an alcoholic and the mother works 12 hours a day. Well, what are there's an uncle, mm-hmm. or there's an aunt in the house. That's positive. Or there's a grandmother. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about that asset and that family and talk how we can, rather than focusing on, oh my gosh, you know, the alcoholism and the, you know, how is it, are they ever going to overcome some of these challenges? So, is that it?
Yeah, I've just had a meeting with Jim Kroll and have his asset mapping, and I'm still in this other, you know, what are the community opportunities? But this is the individual level.
Well, yeah, and then also, though, that would include the and that is a great segue for the next slide. So capacity-focused community development, the way I've approached it, and my colleagues and my my research colleagues, are that we take an inventory of the community's treasure chest. And in the process of this inventorying, we develop important relationships. And that's been part of our stakeholder building strategy. And what's important to remember, though, is asset mapping is not an action step, but asset mobilization is. So, you know, taking an inventory of assets isn't necessarily going to be the action, but mobilizing the assets is the action for collective action, and that requires organizing and harnessing relationships that exist within the community. And often asset mapping lends itself to asset mobilization, sort of obvious.
Yeah. Hi, so you're making so many interesting points, and the one you just said really caught my attention. I think about the parallels between what you're talking about in terms of data collection, that is the asset mapping, and the asset mobilization, which is more action. And
yes.
I see the parallels between that and quality measurement versus quality improvement.
Yes.
You know, where the quality improvement is the action and the measurement is the data gathering.
Excellent point.
But I think a lot of people will say that you can't, the fundamental step of quality improvement is measurement, and you can't really be successful with it until you have measurement. And so, following this through, I think that one could say that one has to do the asset mapping before you can mobilize it and know where it is. But you were clearly saying the opposite of that. You were clearly saying that the asset mapping is not action. My question is, what's in it for you to say, to distinguish them? I mean, you must have had some reason to say the asset mapping isn't action, and I'm trying to understand why are you laying that out that way?
Yeah, and I think your parallel of collecting data versus, you know, when you collect data, nothing happens unless you actually do have some sort of action connected to it, right? Now, people could suggest that collecting data in and of itself creates awareness, and therefore that is a form of mobilization if the individuals who are collecting it are the ones that it's meaningful to them, right? And that's where quality improvement is such a great approach, because you would hope, at least in a setting of, for instance, a clinic setting, that the individuals whose data, the person who's collecting the data actually are the ones who will have some meaning linked to that data.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly that is critical for not just, quality improvement, but also in terms of the quality of the data collection.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, it is interesting. There are nuances.
Mm-hmm.
I think the most important thing is to remember, though, that collecting data or asset collection isn't in and of itself going to get you anywhere in terms of leveraging relationships and mobilizing. You need to have both going on. And I think, you know, I try to remember that even, for instance, when we publish our articles, I'm very much linking myself with our press person to do a press release, because I want it not just to be in the journal, but I want it to be out there so people can actually utilize the data in a manner that would be meaningful. And we'll talk about some of that. And I know I counsel with the younger, now that I'm getting older, the younger faculty to be sure to do that, because a lot of people don't naturally do things like that. And again, it's the same idea. It's like you've collected this, you've analyzed it. Let's get it out there. Let's mobilize it. Okay, so that's actually, gosh, you guys are great because you give me the segue to the next slide. Through my work and my colleagues' research colleagues' work with asset mapping and mobilization, we've been doing research, and the first, I'm going to give you four areas of research that I've worked in LA Unified primarily, because as an example of some stakeholder engagement. And I learned from the master, Charlotte Newman, in the first study that I worked on here at UCLA, which we called the Hunger Study. And this Hunger Study was generated by a series of articles that were in the LA Times in the 90s that were reporting on children coming to school and complaining they had stomach aches and showing up at the nurse's office and getting a sandwich, and then their stomach ache disappeared. And so Charlotte asked the reporter, is there any data on this? Because this is pretty alarming. We thought, you know, the 60s was when we, you know, got the breakfast program into the schools and, you know, hunger should have been gone. And the reporter said this was all anecdotal. And so she and I, with Bill Cumberland and a number of other colleagues, did a randomized stratified sample of schools in LA Unified and picked 14 schools so that we could get not just Latino kids, but Hispanic, Asian American, and African American, and Caucasian children. And we sampled them to ask that question, are children hungry, really? And what we found through this cross-sectional sample, 14 randomly selected schools of 919 children, that 35% of the sample were overweight or at risk for overweight. Now it's been changed to overweight and obese. And that 30% were actually hungry, but 35% were obese or overweight. And this is in 98, before this had hit the airwaves nationally. And we were like, whoa, this is really serious. This is a harbinger of something bad that's happening in our country. And Charlotte and I, with Charlotte's, obviously, it's her idea, we really did the planning, design, and data analysis with all the key LA Unified School District policymakers during the course of this survey. And the policymakers that we collaborated with from the get-go, from when we were starting to do this randomized sample, were the deputy food service director, the principals, the school board members, the staff at the schools, and the LA Unified School District medical director. And during the entire course of collection of the data, we maintained ongoing communication. So we identified the assets. These were all our assets, our key stakeholders in this community. And then we kept on ongoing communication with them. And during that, and we had periodic meetings, and we asked them for their research design suggestions or what we could find out from this survey. And we fed back the results during the data analysis. And so before we even published the study, the deputy food director was saying, what can we do about this problem? This is a serious problem in our school district. We serve these kids breakfast and lunch. What can we do about it? And we said, Bob Gottlieb has helped support salad bars in Santa Monica School District, and now all the salad bars in all elementary schools in Santa Monica have salad bars. And they're actually from the farmer's market. They source the food from the farmer's market. What do you think? And she was like, oh boy. She had just had a big scare. I don't know if you remember, there was the strawberries from Mexico, and she had to give gamma globulin shots to 700,000 kids. And, you know, she was like, oh no, I don't know about that idea. And then she was also about to retire, so all she could remember was wilted salads, you know, salad bars. And so she was like, oh, this, I don't know about that. And I said, well, why don't, Charlotte and I said, well, why don't we take you to Santa Monica School District and we'll have lunch? And that's what we did. And that's what convinced, she said, okay. She went and she saw the little kindergartners picking up the strawberries with the tongs, not with their fingers, and the kids eating, and the one part of Bob Gottlieb's way of presenting the salad bar was to use black bowls to enhance the fruits and vegetables, so it was like enticing to eat the food. And it was fresh and it was delicious. I mean, I really enjoyed eating there as well. And based on that visit and our interactions with the stakeholders, she was willing to pilot study 3 of the 14 schools that we worked in to have salad bars. So what we decided to do was to do sort of give back to the schools that we surveyed. So it wasn't that we just went in there, collected data, and left. We said, what can we do to give back? And so we got the pilot salad bars in 3 of the schools. We also got funding to do Spark training. I don't know if you know about that. It's out of San Diego State, and they teach teachers to promote and teach physical education in a manner that's non-competitive, so that you engage more than just the, you know, jocks in activities. Actually, the heavier kids can participate as well, or the kids that aren't so interested. So we were able to train 3 of the school groups of teachers. And they were another group that are our stakeholders, were the teachers. We went back and told all the teachers our findings as well. And it was interesting because one of those schools that got the Spark education, initially the teacher who was the head of the lobby, you know, each of the labor unions have a rep at each of the schools. And she was like, oh no, we don't have an overweight or obese problem here. And so we showed her the data that we had collected from her school, and she said, oh. And so she actually made time out of their regular time to get the teachers to be trained for the Spark because of that information. She was, you know, it was important to her. And then the data also supported the inception of the Nutrition Network Program, which has been a program in LA Unified for the last 13 years. It's brought a lot of resources, millions of dollars. And then we also participated in early community meetings that helped launch Harold Goldstein's advocacy program over that he has at Davis. Based on this data that we collected, just this baseline data, and we went out there and tried to make sure it went out to all the major stakeholders. So the lessons learned from that study were early and ongoing participation with PU stakeholders facilitates the process of action through research. I mean, it's obvious, but it was really nice to see it actually worked. It was very organic. And that academic and policymaker collaboration facilitates program implementation that responds to the health needs within the individual school districts. And giving back to organizations, individuals, and communities where you conduct research leads to strong future collaborations. And that's what I'm going to describe now. Based on that one study, we did what I told you was the salad bar evaluation, that 3 pilot schools. And in that, we got a small grant to evaluate a cross-sectional group of the kids that we had pre and post intervention. And we found that the frequency of fruit and vegetable consumed was up significantly after the salad bar was introduced. And those 3 schools, one was the was Castellar, which is the predominantly Asian school, one was a predominantly Latino school, and one was a predominantly African American school. So we were able to show, at least in the pilot study, that that worked. And that was based on our original collaboration with the deputy director. Again, continuing our relationship with the food group, or LA Unified School District food group, you know, they feed the French and the British Army combined every day, just to give you an example of what they do every day. They feed 700,000 meals a day. They feed more than any fast food restaurant in LA County. They serve that many meals. Even though the leadership in the district changed, because of our past relationships, they have continued to work with us. So we did another salad bar evaluation that was a little bit more rigorous with a control and intervention group, and we added some education and we added some point of decision prompts, and again we found some positive outcomes. And again last year, a new leadership, completely new, we did a whole another study with them looking at introducing salad bars in addition to the changes in the menu that they, you know, had last year. And we found not only that the more days kids ate from salad bars, the more the vegetables they ate, but we also found that their body mass index decreased significantly.
Cool.
Yeah. Now we also added a few things to that. We added a letter home to the parents to tell them what the BMI of their child was. and what they should do about it. Sorry, I'm going through my own things here. There we go. So what did we learn from our Salivar studies was that continued early and ongoing collaboration with key stakeholders helped to facilitate the research and the process of action through research. And examples of participation in this sort of iteration of our work in LA Unified were that we were very responsive. If the food people wanted us to participate in like a board meeting, we would go down and present our data. We also actually went to DC and presented our data to congressional hearings. And we also provided study write-ups. We also, of course, at a more local level, we provided cash incentives to schools to participate. I think we always have to value our partners in any research setting. But I always try to give back. I try to always give it either money or equipment or something to connect them, connect the schools with whatever we're doing or at a higher level. We've given gift cards to cafeteria managers, and we've also provided funding for Salivar equipment, over $80,000 we've provided over time to LA Unified School District through our grants funding. A third of our grant funding often will end up being given as some sort of equipment or service or incentive.
So that's been embedded in your grant proposals, that a third of it would go to?
Well, it depends on the grant.
What about
that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We feel we're very committed to that, and partly because, I think in any day, but these days in particular, I can't rely on other people buying equipment. You know, I want to make sure they're paying for the food, though, because mm-hmm. it's part of the food program. That's part of the federal program. So it's a sustainable intervention, because once they get the equipment lasts 10 to 20 years. So they can just, keep it going after mm-hmm. the research, which is sort of a nice, super nice part of it. One of the reasons I like it so much. So nutrition-friendly schools was another iteration. So we started with sort of these district-wide kinds of activities that then created our relationships strengthening with the food services and also with the district and then also with Nutrition Network. And so our collaboration with the Nutrition Network, LA Unified, and ourselves, our team now expanding to include Mike Prelip, Charlotte, myself, and others, we developed this model called the Nutrition Friendly School and Community Model, which basically was generated collectively, and it was an asset-based strategy for engaging school community stakeholders to become actively involved in changing the nutrition and physical activity environment of their schools. So this, we developed a strategy for collectively with the schools and developed a model that combined 8 environmental components of the coordinated school health model that the CDC had identified with the accreditation approach of the Baby Friendly Hospital Initiative to provide school community stakeholders the overarching planning and evaluation structure needed to improve nutritional and physical activity at their schools. And we got a CDC grant, one of the first, I think, CDC grants for participatory research, and we implemented this. And we found the lessons learned from that was that actually this kind of engagement really did resonate with the schools, and they were able to implement the steps, 13 out of the 15 that were identified as key, one school completing them all within a year based on this sort of collaborative process that was generated from the schools themselves. With our support. Now, this particular project had a fault to it, though, and this is one of the things that I guess we should have known from the get-go, but we didn't. We did not engage the wellness coordinator early on with our project, and therefore this actual work that we've done with nutrition-friendly schools has not gone district-wide. unlike the salad bar, which actually became part of the obesity motion within the school board member, this particular project has not taken off. And so we fell into a common error that a lot of researchers fall into, and we're going to resurrect that because the medical director really wants to take this on and bring this to another level, which is nice. Kim, you made
it. So the problem was you didn't have the wellness coordinator engaged. Did they act against you, or were they just a critical, was it the evil witch that wasn't at the baptism, you know?
Right.
Or was it
she just wasn't with us going forward, and then her boss therefore wasn't, and therefore they went with more of the coordinated school CDC intervention, and she was wonderful, actually. Mm-hmm. Cherie, she was one of one for the entire district too. That of course was a constraint, because if you only have one person doing that, it was, she had to sort of do what she could do in different parts of the district. But I think it also had to do with us not engaging with her early on, and then having her boss get engaged. That's my assessment. Mm-hmm. Especially based on reflecting, if you reflect on all the other successes we had with the district's food service people. So those are the experiences we've had with sort of more system-wide change. And I wanted to just reflect on one other approach we've done, which is an individual kind of work looking at assets. And that's, we've worked with parents of preschoolers in LA Unified and also at Venice Family Clinic. And in a way, this is sort of a curious way that this came together, this particular project. In a way, I was kind of a stakeholder as well as a researcher, because what happened was when I was at the clinic counseling preschool moms with preschoolers about optimizing the nutrition and physical activity of their kids, they would be like, yeah, I get it. You know, I know my kids need to eat more fruits and vegetables, but how do I do it? I get that, but how? And I realized that I didn't have the time to really strategize and work with them on the how. And so I identified an asset here at UCLA, Fred Frankel, who's done a ton of work in parenting over the last 30 years and has developed a really excellent intervention for parenting and based on social learning. And it's all parent groups that will learn from each other with a facilitator. And so we merged our science of what we wanted to introduce to parents in terms of knowledge, nutrition, physical activity, with his parenting, and we developed a 7-week, once a week class with two boosters classes that what focus was to optimize parenting with nutrition, physical activity messages. And we found at 1 year outcomes, and this was a randomized control study. Bill Cumberland developed a computerized program for us, and so we couldn't put those extra heavy kids in. We recruited actually healthy weight and overweight and obese children into the study, and we found that at 1 year, children's Z-scores were significantly better compared to the children whose parents did not take the parenting classes. Other findings were also significant, and but what was of interest to this particular presentation is that one of the sites that we did the research in liked this intervention so much that they wanted to develop a promotora model, because we were using a social worker to facilitate the classes. And so Children's Bureau, which is downtown serving all low-income families, applied for a UCLA Chancellor's Grant with us being their technical supporter, and they got it, and they also tested this with a promotora model and found that it also was successful. Again, I think this reflects, not only did we engage Children's Bureau to be part of this research, but we also supported their initiative in taking on the next iteration of what we would like to see this as translation to the community. And that was very, very satisfying. What we learned from this series of it was a four-year project ultimately, was that we could make positive impact on families and children's nutrition. We also found, of course, which just seems so obvious, but that parents of young children should, the intervention should take place in the community where they live and gather on a regular basis. Because originally we started the parent classes all at the clinic, but problem at our clinic is that patients come from all over and can take three buses and it might take them an hour and a half to get there. So we actually ended up moving the classes to the child care sites or the preschool or the family centers. And then our participation and retention went way up. And that also that high priority issues need to be linked to other important topics like nutrition and physical activity, of which the parenting was a high priority topic for our parents. And so that by us linking it with nutrition, that created a much more higher incentive. Because a lot of parents thought they understood nutrition or physical activity, but the parenting part is what they didn't know. But of course, they had a lot of questions about nutrition when it came down to it during the classes.
So maybe I missed this, but you said the Z-scores, what are the Z-scores? Nutrition, physical activity, or the weight, or
so the Z-scores is another way of saying BMI. It's like the percentile, so it could be standard deviations.
Yeah, I know Z-scores in general, but we were talking about BMI then.
Correct, yeah. Yeah.
So
what we had observed, one of the reasons we instituted it was not just for the parenting, but that we were finding ourselves doing a lot of parenting coaching in the clinic, but we also looked at data at our clinic at four-year-olds, and I went back and looked at them at when they were two, and 20% of our four-year-olds when they were two were either overweight or obese, but by four, 40% of them were. It had doubled. And so we felt that we needed to take on the healthy weight and the overweight and obese kids and consider that they were all high risk for gaining weight. And so we recruited all of those, and that's how we, so our goal was not to necessarily have, we didn't want them to lose weight, we just wanted them not to increase, we didn't want them to go marching up higher than what, and what they've been doing. Does that address what you're wondering? Yeah. So
so is there anything about historically what's happened? I remember in some talk, Bob Brook was saying, what's the availability of food that's high calories and what's the big problem? Because what has happened with the parents here? What are you teaching them? Are they like eating out too fast food too much? Or what's the main problem going on? Correct.
Yeah, that's a really good question. And, you know, interestingly, at least in the population we were counseling, and we were obviously just focusing on the preschool population, those children were not eating out as much, although there was enough of them eating out that at 1 year follow-up, we did find significant reduction in fast food consumption among the intervention group, or frequency, not consumption, but frequency of going to, reporting of going to fast food establishments. Their physical activity and their screen time, these children, in this age group, at least those that were, you know, they all actually pretty much, intervention and control group, pretty much followed the recommendations of at least an hour of physical activity and less than 2 hours of TV or screen time. So that was kind of an interesting, we were surprised by that finding. But I think I have a feeling that as they get older, that at least from my observation in the clinic, they go up, they up that. But at least in this age group, they were not. It was a 2 to 5 year olds by the time they were followed up. And it was really primarily probably a constellation of factors. One of the biggest challenges that this group had to change, and they did change, but was the way they, Leanne Birch from Penn State does all the child feeding. She has a child feeding questionnaire. It's all about pressure of eating and finishing your plate. And so I think it primarily is a portion probably issue. We did do 24-hour food recalls, but the problem with that was halfway through the study, a lot of the kids ended up in Head Start, and so we didn't have the resources to go in and observe what the kids were eating at Head Start, and so we didn't have a very good data set for the 24-hour food recalls for the kids to really make an assessment. We haven't drilled in to some of the meal time though, which we could, and Lenora probably can help me with some, guiding me in that area. Because we're still doing some analysis about the data. But it's interesting also, especially in this population, most of them were Mexican-American, and they treated, at least from the child feeding questionnaire baseline, they dealt with their boys differently than their girls, and they had more permissive feeding patterns with their boys than they did with their girls. And we do see that in the national data set, that Mexican-American boys are heavier than girls. So there might be some kind of fine reasons for that. Is that, So right now we're still in the process of trying to work to make this relevant, not just, as a great journal article, but actually make it a difference. So we're working on developing RO1 because we, granted this was a pilot, and also we're developing a telehealth kind of approach to delivering these classes. We're going to be piloting this in LA Unified School District, where we, Fred Frankel is going to be here at UCLA, and he's going to facilitate a group class of parents in Southgate. And we'll see how that works. And then also we're working closely with Santa Monica School District because they really want to adopt this in their Head Start program. And then we're hoping that perhaps this could be translatable to other Head Start programs, since they have a mandate to teach parents, and nutrition is certainly one of their high priority areas. One of the things that I found in the literature that I thought was important for us, and certainly we observed it as well, was that, low-income minority parents of young children. I think the young parents of young children, if any of us are in the room with young children, know it's just time is a huge limiting factor, I think more than at any stage of parenting, and priorities and unstable schedules and lack of transportation, all of these play into engaging individuals in your research at that level. So, like I said, we'd love to have research impact policy, and some of the Salabar work actually has been cited in reports like the IOM report on school meals. Our Salabar study was referenced as evidence for Salabars being an important part of the school meal plan. We also, they were integrated into two federal bills. The Let's Move Salabars to Schools relied on our Salabar studies to support that activity. And LA Unified School District also adopted a motion where all schools in LA Unified, if they want a Salabar, could have one. And I'll never forget, Rick Brown told me in the 90s, I said, so how do you make a difference? And he said, find something commonsensical, study it, publish it, and then pass it on to the policymakers. They only need one study. So I thought that was a great piece of advice. And if it's common sense and you do a good, a study that's worthwhile publishing, that really has stayed with me.
How did you pass it on to the policymakers? So, in there with Boxer and the legislation, did you write it?
So. Yeah, great question. So at the local level, we went and spoke at school at the school board meetings, and we also worked with the school board members initially and worked with their staffers and fed the research back to them on an ongoing basis. Clearly, the ones that were interested in nutrition. Yeah. And then at the level of federal level, they found us, mm-hmm. and Lorelei DiSidoria, do you know her?
Yeah.
She is the one who's responsible for the Caption 5 a Day here in the state of California. And then she worked at the National Cancer Institute and was very focused on fruit and vegetables as a way, obviously, to prevent cancer. And she came across our salad bar study, which was the first study that actually was showed evidence for low-income communities making a difference in terms of that intervention. And granted, it was just a pilot and there was no comparison. That's why we ended up doing the second study. But she then engaged us, or not engaged us, but asked us to come when they were working on the hunger and the healthy, what's that? I always get mixed it up. What's the bill? Hunger Kids and Health, Hunger and Healthy Kids Act that Obama signed a year and a half, 2 years ago, that changed the whole lunch program. That was the IOM report that Gail Harrison was part of the committee for, that basically doubled the fruit, recommended that they double the fruit at breakfast and double the fruit and vegetables at lunch, and whole grains be increased in the food lunch program. And that was an IOM report that then got translated to the law. And then but they were like, so how do you, even if you offer it, how are you going to get a kid to eat it? Well, salad bars work. When kids have a choice and they have many choices and the food's cut up, they eat it. If it's not cut up, if it's served to them and they only have one, they don't have more than one, they don't have many choices. It's all common sense, right? So we went, and so Boxster, she asked me if I could find a school in LA where Boxster's staffers could come and visit. And so we went to Hooper Elementary in South Central, which is one of the sites that we had a school. And that school, the first day of the salad bar, the kids were coming up to me and kissing the oranges and saying, this is the best day of my life. I'm not kidding. I mean, it was like, I mean, it just makes you want to work on salad bars for the rest of your life. The kind of response that you get for salad bars.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's just, you know, if you can make it the best day of someone's life, a salad bar. So we brought him, I made the effort to go. Again, it was like, you know, I was willing to, you know, it was responding to a request. And so I took him to the Boxster staffer, and then he told Boxster she should go for it. And, you know, it's not a very a controversial thing. That's the great thing about salad bars. I think, you know, from a personal lessons learned about how to engage people, I would just say the qualities that I've been trying to develop for myself are to listen, observe, and reflect. And I think reflecting is really important. And then once you've done all that, to take some action steps. So,
who's got theirs on?
I'd love to have people let me, who has their pedometer on? I'd love to have you share with me any of your tips of engagement or challenges that I could learn from you as well, because I know this was just my story and there's so many ways to do it.
Well, thank you for that. But it's so, I didn't know you were going to say this, and I happened yesterday to see the TED Talk by Ernesto Cercoli. Does anyone know it? And it's called, If You Want to Help Someone, Shut Up and Listen. He worked with USAID in Africa on failed after failed after failed project, and you know what he learned after that. He does a very entertaining TED Talk, is, you know, go in there and just sit there and listen to what they want and find out what the assets are from the individual saying that's what they want to do. But I know people are often afraid to do this. They'll get sucked in. They'll never get any research done. It will overwhelm them. And I know when I was at UNC, a colleague of mine got involved with the Pathway Studies, Native American Indian Study. And, you know, they couldn't publish anything from it. They were so bogged down with the negotiations of every little piece that it was very challenging. So did you get lucky? Or is it your personality that makes this work? Or why do some succeed and others don't?
Yeah, I don't know, I believe there is, I've had this conversation, what is luck and what is timing? And I think timing is probably, luck does have something to do with timing, and timing has something to do with luck. But I think when you're ready for something, the timing and the luck then translate into something successful. And I think it's, again, probably what you just described, listening and also being responsive. I think that you really want to also be respectful and be there and be giving. You know, for instance, the Spark training, we got money from Nutrition Network to do the training, and there was nothing in it for us except to give that training. We didn't even do an assessment or anything. And one of those reps asked me, what is it in for you? Like, she couldn't believe we were just gonna give them that training. And I was like, this is not, we just, because you were one of the schools that we originally assessed, we wanna give back to you. And she was like, really? So, I mean, it's not that often that you get that kind of opportunity to do that, but I think if you get, people are surprised. I mean, I don't, you know, just, I was sort of surprised too. I know that, please feel free to say, tell me more, but I wanted to say, I found this quote, which I really like too, which is, with realizations of one's own potential and self-confidence in one's ability, one can build a better world. And so, you know, I feel like the Dalai Lama has a lot to say about, like, personal, you know, reflection and also listening. He's a big listener, and I think that I've learned from people, the masters like that, and Charlotte Newman and a lot of others. I don't know if anyone else would like to share their successes or any questions.
That was a great talk. Thanks so much.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you. Thanks for listening.
Did you have something?
Thanks for including me.
Oh, this is going to ask. I don't know if you mentioned this at the beginning of the week, I'm sorry I wasn't able to see, but you described interventions that seemed like they rested on a really mature relationship with the schools. And I'm wondering about the process of that initial relationship with an expected public. What are the keys to that?
So, the relationship with an individual school, in other words, or the district?
Whichever it was that was necessary.
Yeah. First. Well, so the mature relationship with the district really started when we did our first assessment of the schools in the late 90s, and we engaged numbers of key stakeholders at the administrative level to participate in our planning of our research. Now, the schools themselves, most of them I approached cold calls to get engaged initially, and I learned very quickly that you don't try to get a yes or no answer on the phone. You get an appointment with the principal, and then you tell them. And I didn't get a no from any principal once I got in the door. So, but that you don't learn in medical school. But, it was interesting. The schools have gone through a lot, though, and so I've seen it's harder and harder for a lot of principals who really would like to participate to even get an appointment with them sometimes because of the time constraints they have, because a lot of them don't even have assistant principals anymore. So that's a challenge, but it has never deterred me in that way. You know, you just have to work around it and be very receptive and non-demanding. You know, that's the other thing, that you have to be sure to be willing to go with everyone else's schedule and not your own. Just an aside, though, just a guerrilla research aside.
Yeah.
On our second salad bar, we had a kind of contract with the funder that wouldn't give us an easy conduit through UCLA to give the money that we were supposed to LA Unified to buy the salad bars. And we were obviously a calendar for school to get the salad bars in to get, we had gotten the baseline data, but we had to get the salad bars in to do the post before school got out. And UCLA just, you know, it was one of those sort of labyrinths of bureaucracy that we just would go around and round. So finally the food people at LA Unified said, you know, look, we can probably find idling salad bars for now use, and we just need the supplies, and then eventually I'm sure we'll figure out where to get the, we can get the money over to buy the salad, replace those salad bars. So, because a lot of salad bars were bought when new construction took place for new schools, and then the schools weren't using them. They were using them like for bookcases and things. So some schools were willing to lend them to our project, and others were like, no, because they were afraid they would never get them back. But the supplies were a problem because we had to get those and they were expensive. But they were supplies, they weren't equipment. Because part of what UCLA had trouble with was that who was going to own the equipment and who was liable for the equipment if someone got hurt. And so the supplies though, so I put everything, $10,000 worth of supplies on my credit card and had them delivered here. And I got reimbursed, and it was all legitimate, but no one. And then we took a van of my friends, and we went to every school, that intervention school, at the loading dock, and dropped off the supplies. So you do what you have to do sometimes, you know.
That's great.
So, but that's not about stakeholder engagement, but that's about how to do research in two bureaucracies.
Yeah. They're bad about moving money, moving it quickly. Yeah.
Right, and. Fortunately, because I think CTSI has really influenced it, IRB has really gotten to be so efficient. Yeah. And I think it's a lot to do with CTSI.
More to be done, but yes, it's a high priority issue.
It's huge. I mean, I'm so ever grateful. Someone was working on Thanksgiving for me, actually.
Well,
so,
thank you very much.
That was great.
Thank you. Really appreciate
so much.
I saw the email. Yeah.